Hello, everyone. It's 8:31, so it's time for us to begin. Let me just get the date. It is the 19th of April. I'm reading my thing here. The 22nd day of the Omer and the 7th of Iyar. And happy to be here. Let me, as always, pick up on a few things that were said last class first for those who asked about this view of the two people of Ramosha Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, Lahalot et Isur, to raise the level of an Isur. Actually, he did it in a case where you had both a positive commandment and a negative, even though we don't usually assume it's the negative in that particular case. Since the Ramban held it is, he says we should stress that. But this idea of making something worse than it is to keep people away from sin, we're going to deal with that in future classes, because I think I'm going to do classes on the rise of the reform movement and the halachic response, which we're done in a few classes. I listened to the class last week. I see I made a mistake. No one corrected me, so I will clarify it. I said that the author of the Masoras HaShas on the side that gives you the cross references, that's Rav Yishaya Pick. Actually, he just did the additions to it. It's Yehoshua Boaz. One of you, I've been holding this for a long time, so I'll just say it quickly now. One of you wanted, we spoke already months ago about, and Mel had, we had a conversation with Mel about how sometimes in the davening, the tune doesn't work with the, not the tune, the, yeah, the accent doesn't work with the tune. That is, we pronounce words in order to make a rhyme, but that's not in line with how the Hebrew language should be pronounced. So someone asked, well, what about, are there cases of where because of the song, we divide the verse, not with the accent, but we divide it in a way that it doesn't mean what it should. Now, for that, there's all sorts of stuff. And I don't think you can, I don't think it's possible to fight what the minhag is. I have a number of examples, but just the other day I saw one by Rabbi Shmuel Ashkenazi, who we're going to be dealing with him soon. So I'll cite the one he gives. Here is Kedusha. I'm sure we have a lot of chazanim here. I just took this off Otzer HaChachma. It's one of the old Sidurim from America, and he actually gets it right. Look here where the Chazan says, we usually pronounce this as follows, or say it as follows. Azbeko rash gadol, comma, adir v'chazak mashmiim kol. But of course, that's said that way. Remember, azbeko rash gadol, comma, adir v'chazak mashmiim kol. What this means is that there's two guys named Adir v'chazak, and they're mashmim kol. That's not what it means. It should be pronounced either Oz with a comma or Oz b'kol rash gadol adir v'chazak, comma, then mashmim kol, because we're talking about the angels. The translation, I'll just read you the translation I have here from the Sachs version. Then with a sound of mighty noise, majestic and strong, comma, they make their voice heard, comma, raising themselves to the seraphim. So, but what are you going to do? That's the tune. It's hard to change that. Let me put this aside. Mel said something a few weeks ago. We were having this whole discussion about driving on Shabbos. Well, being in a carriage on Shabbos, that sort of thing. I cited what Mendelssohn, he had the problem that the king insisted that he come visit him. And Mel said that Rabbi Katz, Rabbi David Katz, who does very interesting, he's a rabbi in Baltimore, also a PhD at Johns Hopkins. He wrote a PhD on the Notabi Yehuda. Very interesting. I have a PDF of it if anyone's interested. Mel said that Rabbi Katz mentioned that there's a responsum by Dr. Montalto permitting going in a carriage driven by a non-Jew on Shabbos. And I said at the time, thank you for that, Mel, but I don't know who Dr. Montalto is. So then Mel, we had correspondence and he reminded me. I did know, but I forgot. It's this individual, Elijah Montalto, who you can read about him on Wikipedia. I was confused. I thought he was referring to this person, Amatus Lusitanus, who was, I th- who's actually in Salonika. I thought he was in Constantinople, lived around the same time, also was a doctor, also from a Portuguese Murano family, and a much more important doctor. But what's important for us is that Dr. Montalto actually wrote a responsum. I have the responsum here. I found it. I could send it to anyone, in which he had someone write it for him or he wrote it, in which he does explain, and I understand where my cat summarized it, why there shouldn't be a problem for him, at least, to go with the carriage on Shabbos. He says, first of all, it's a rabbinic prohibition, and for you to go in a carriage, and if the non-Jew is doing it, it's a double rabbinic called a shvus to shvus. And he explains that he's a doctor and he needs to visit patients. It's a tshuva. It's about 10 pages. He says it's also an oneg Shabbos. You're going to force him, he says, to walk everywhere in the city when he has to go visit the patients. And so you see that there is such a concept. It's not totally out of left field. Furthermore, there was a great rabbi in Morocco. His name was Yitzhak Ben Walid. I'll show you a picture of him. He was in Tetouan in Morocco, and he was asked a question, and he died in 1870. He was asked a question. I thought I pulled up the, here he is. He was asked a question from Gibraltar in the 19th century. The bride would go to shul on the Shabbos before her wedding. And if there's a lot of rain and she can't walk because her clothes will get soaked, can a non-Jew bring her in a carriage? Rabbi Ibn Walid, he's the author of Responsa Vayomer Yitzhak, he thought it's permissible. Because it's a shvus to shvus. Riding in a carriage is a rabbinic prohibition. Having the non-Jew take you, that's shvus to shvus, because asking a non-Jew to do it is also rabbinic. He didn't want to rule halacha l'maisa, but he says he doesn't see any problem. He sees this as a dvar mitzvah, that the Shabbos before the wedding, the bride will come to shul. Incidentally, this rabbi, Ibn Walid, if you notice, he has a ring on his finger. So we see that wearing rings. I don't know if that was a wedding ring or what. Rabbi Mazuz mentions that when he got married, his father bought him a ring, because in Tunisia they'd wear wedding rings. But when he came to Israel, he stopped wearing it, because the Haredi world, you don't wear wedding rings. But you see it right there. Rabbi Ibn Walid has a ring on his finger. Two more things I want to share with you. It perhaps wasn't clear what David Eisen nicely pointed out last week. We are talking about Rav Avraham ben Arambam. And Rav Avraham ben Arambam says that the Talmud, although the Talmud says that the reason for Mayim Achronim is because of the harsh salt, the Ma'al Sodomis, he says that that's just a reason to get people to do it, so that they're afraid of the Ma'al Sodomis. But the real reason is it's preparation for benching, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa. I made it seem as if I didn't know where he gets this from. And David pointed out correctly that you see it in Brachos. Brachos says explicitly here on 53b, it says, they're quoting from a pasuk, the word v'hiskashtem that's in Vayikra Perachof, refers to Mayim Rishonim. V'yisem Kadoshim refers to Mayim Achronim. So although all the poskim cite the other example, that is in Holon, as I recall, that the real reason is because of Melech Sodomis, and they just see this as like an extra thing, adding on to it, to give it so that you don't think it's only a health concern. But on the contrary, the Rav Ben Rama says that this, what we're looking at right now, is the real reason. And the other reason, Melech Sodomis, is not a real reason. It's just a reason given to people to keep them attached so that they won't have to take it more seriously. So thank you for that, David. Two more things. Machitza. Actually, before I do Machitza, I want to show you something. I haven't showed you in a video in a long time. So I'll show you two videos. I'm going to upset some of maybe our Williamsburg people, but I don't think so, because they know that I'm not anti-Satmar. They know that we have Baruch, and if Shiner is with us today, Israel, they can testify. After one of my talks in Borough Park, they brought me to a gathering of Satmar where we had Malav Malka. I can tell you that I know many people in Satmar. I've been to Kiryas Yoel. The late Yitzhak Brach, who was a big Satmar printer, was in my house in Brookline. I was in his house when I was in Williamsburg last for a, I was there to see some people. The Satmar Rebbe, both Satmar Rebbe's nephew, came to see me to speak to me. So no one's going to accuse me of being anti-Satmar. What I am is anti, and I said I don't care about, they want to be anti-Zionist, that's fine. What I don't like is their lack of respect that they teach in the school to Gedolei Yisrael, not of their camp, and if they, and when they get involved with anti-Israel things in the political sense, not just in the theological sense, if they're just like the Eda Haredit, that's fine. And in fact, the Satmar I know would agree with me 100%. So I said in one of the previous classes, you might recall that the Satmar Chinuch, it's terrible. So someone said, well, that's not a very liberal thing to say. The Satmar Chinuch, I'm supposed to be open-minded. You know, isn't one of the themes of this, all my classes is that there's good on the right and there's good on the left. And yeah, but I agree. And there is some good in the Satmar Chinuch. But let me show you a couple things. When you see what I'm showing you now, you will understand exactly what I mean, that Satmar ideology in the public sense is dangerous. It's anti-Semitic even. Why do I say it's anti-Semitic? Because the things I show you were said by non-leftists or by Arabs or anyone else, a congressperson, you would say this. Just to let people know what I mean when I say their chinuch is dangerous and the fact that no one condemns it, you have to ask the big people. Let me just show you two examples of this and see it and weep. Here's one. Let me pull it up on the screen here. Actually, no, this is not the one I want to show you first. I'll show you the different one first. Then you'll see that one. This is from the Satmar camp. Look at how they indoctrinate the kids. This is a form of child abuse.
Was jeder eine weiß, als sein Koide am Zahrodi mag seide, als sein Scharodi mag sach geseide, als sich zweiten bis jetzt am Zahrodi mag seide, als alle Bucherem, wir sind kommen im Militär, in kein Bucher tun, ich bleibe mir in Schiebe lehnen, in jeder Bucher mitnehmen, a Bix in seinen, in kein Bucher gegen die Arabers, wo sie noch mit dem Häufer auf der drei Schiels, bis der Eibestritt in Verschwoiden. Was der Schwierf hat er einfach geduckt. Oben wird nicht folgen der Schwierf, wird die laufende Goya in Zeigen als euch wie die Herrscher von der Feld. Die Joine haben umgehoben, die zweite Wärme kommen. Demmels ist interessant, hat Hitler gesucht. Dasselbe Welt. Die Joine haben umgehoben, die Joine haben gemacht, eine Sache, als keine Tunisch handeln mit Arabisch. Mit Deutschland in Demmels hat Hitler gesucht, als er wird hergen in ihn wie der Herrscher vom Feld. Demmels im Kind geworden, er wird Eifstrahl gesucht, als wenn die Jiden wollen, als wenn die Jiden wollen, bekommen halt mit der Goyim, wird er sagen, in der Zeustag geschehen, in Assach, jede Splittische war gossen geworden wegen dem. So, was er wird auch noch mit ihnen, soll schon hintergehen, was hier, soll schon kommen mit mir, mit meinen Jungen.
Okay, so Zionists started World War II. They're the reason for the Holocaust, and we should hope for the state to be destroyed. That'll be a good plan. We all talk about the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and things like that. Here you have indoctrinating the children that the Zionists are responsible for World War II. But, and look at this. This is from the next one. This is from a camp. And this is chinuch. They tell the kids that Netanyahu is in the car. And look what they teach them to do. That's chinuch. Watch this. Again, summer camp.
Yeah.
So they teach the kids to throw, they tell them Netanyahu's in there, and the game is to throw eggs at the car. If that isn't disgusting, and that's the way you teach children, that's what I mean when I say that that's a form of child abuse. Two more things, and then we have to begin. I just want to clarify last week about Rabbi Henkin and davening in a shul without a machitza, because I have it right here. It's in the writings of Rabbi Henkin, volume 2, page 11. What he says is as follows. If you're in a situation where there's a shul and it has mixed seating, what he says is the Gedolim, Kvar Horu, have ruled that it's better to daven by yourself. However, if there's no other place to go to, and you will be forced to daven tamid yechidi, doesn't mean one Shabbos. It means, I guess, as a permanent basis. You're the only where you're living or where you are for a year, whatever. The only shul is a shul where they have mixed seating. He says, Yesha rein bazeh ad hechan magi hakilko. He says, you need to examine this, how bad this is going to be. In other words, it could be that by not going to shul for an entire year, you lose all connection to Judaism. So you have to look, first of all, how bad that will be. And I think that's what it means, ad hecha megi al kilkul, not a kilkul to you, but kilkul, not the kilkul that by going there, but the kilkul that you won't have a minion. And he says, and also, hatikfa al hatikun mishtat fudak sherid. Also, the fact that maybe you could help matters, because the religious Jews, if they join in with the Orthodox Jews, if they join in this shul, they could improve matters. And then he says, "Val kol panim sarich limchot." You have to protest and rebuke them if you daven there bedochak. If you feel that you have to daven there because you have no choice. So that's what it's clear. What he means is, ad hecha magi al kilkul, how to you, by not having any shul. He says, nevertheless, if you do go there, you have to try to convince them to make it proper. That's in contradiction to Rav Soloveitchik, as we know, or as everyone says, that not even to hear Tekiyas HaShofar. But I did say last week, and a few people were a bit incredulous, that I said that he was not always so strict on this. So the last thing I will do is I'm going to tell you why I said that. I didn't just make this up. You know me now long enough to know that I don't make things up. It's as follows. Why did I say that the Rav could be more liberal on non-machitza minyanim, even though he himself made these declarations? Don't step foot even here to Kiyas HaShofar. Yeshiva University publishes a Torah journal called Beis Yitzchak every year or so. It's if you look in the 2006 issue, Rav Herschel Schechter has material he put together there from Rav Soloveitchik, which then was included in Divrei HaRav. Rav Schechter's published three volumes of Rav Soloveitchik. What I'm going to tell you now was not included there. Why wasn't included? I never asked him. You can ask him if you want. Either he was convinced not to, he was told what he's going to say now could have a negative impact on Orthodoxy. I don't know why, but this is what it says. He says, I once heard from Rabbi Zerubbabel Shosheim. I don't really know much about Rabbi Zerubbabel Shosheim. If you go on the YU website, you have a picture of him here. Unfortunately, you see, he died young. He was American-born student of the Rav, a Rosh Hashiva at YU. So he says as follows, that when he was a young student and he was learning for smicha, the practice was that many students would take shtelas positions for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. We know that there's many shuls that don't have rabbis all year, but Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they need a rabbi. They need someone to give the sermon. That's like a big deal, or to run the show, to get some money. And he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, maybe you can help me find a shul in Boston. And Rabbi Soloveitchik asked him, an Orthodox shul or a conservative shul? When he says conservative, what he means here is, as we'll see, it's a mixed seating shul. That's sort of Schechter writing conservative. It's mixed seating. There are many so-called Orthodox shuls that, what does it mean, Orthodox? That is, they belong to the OU, as opposed to the United Synagogue, which were mixed seating. Today, there's no more Orthodox shuls. The last one, they've kicked it out a few years ago, Beis Midrash HaGadol in Denver. But in the 40s and 50s, you had loads of shuls and mixed seating. And Rabbi Soloveitchik himself sent students to be rabbis in these shuls. But he sent rabbis in these shuls to try to get them to put machitzas in. And we're not talking about like just for Rosh Hashanah to make some money. By the way, the other yeshivas did the same thing. Beth Jacob, the big shul in Atlanta, where Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, he came from Neri Yisrael. That was a mixed seating shul. All the yeshivas pretty much did this. So he says, he asked him, is it Orthodox or conservative? Because you know that you can make more money in a conservative shul. But Rabbi Shusheim asks him, Rebbe, can you go into such a shul where they sit together? And Rav Soloveitchik says, in my opinion, and I say this with all understanding of the consequences, one who davens in a shul where men and women sit together, it's as if you're davening in a church. But then the Rav says, and we all know what I just read, but this is what we don't know. But I know that many rabbis, Talmidei Chachamim, don't agree with me at this time. And the most famous one was Rabbi Regensburg. Rabbi Regensburg believed that Orthodox rabbis should go to the conservative shuls, and even not just on a temporary basis. And the results were that many of these non-machitza shuls became machitza shuls. After all, if you don't go, even for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, if the Orthodox rabbi doesn't go, what are they going to do? They're going to get a conservative rabbi. And next thing you know, the shul, at least now, it's basically an Orthodox shul. The only thing it's not Orthodox is they don't have mechitza, but they don't use a microphone, and they use an Orthodox sitter. It's not egalitarian. If all of a sudden you're going to bring in a conservative rabbi, then the whole shul will go conservative. So you can understand the opposition to Rav Soloveitchik. But Rav Soloveitchik says, so I say to you, if you want to rely on those rabbis who differ from me and are lenient, I will help you to find such a position. And if you want to follow my position, I will help you to find that as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not agree that someone should go. We're not talking about a case where you go like for a few years to try to get into the mechitzin. This is just to make money. But Rabbi Soloveitchik said, there are people who disagree with me, and as I said, this is a very different position than we usually get from Rav Soloveitchik, and it's not in the Divrei HaRav, but you can find it in the YU Torah Journal, Beis Yitzchak. Let us now continue. We have great stuff today, troubling stuff also. Hopefully we'll get to three of the tshuvot. We're on page 334, and this is Siman Kuf Nun Vav. It's 334. The book has, let's say, 371 pages. So we're really making progress here. Before I read you, discuss the Siman, I want to read you something I got in the email just on Friday. It's from Rabbi Avraham Marmorstein. Those who live on the Upper West Side might know the name. He's the rabbi of the Minchas Chinuch Shul on the Upper West Side. He also gives hashachas there, totally from the Haredi world. I don't know why they call the shul the Minchas Chinuch Shul. They call it Minchas Chinuch Babad. Babad is the name of the Minchas Chinuch family. I'm not sure. I actually never went there, even though I lived in the Upper West Side, but it's an old shul. And Rabbi Marmorstein is also, he comes from English family. His father, Emil Marmorstein, was actually a leader of Neturei Karta, if you can believe it. Cambridge graduate, but an intellectual leader of Neturei Karta. And his grandfather was Arthur Marmorstein, who he's named after, Avraham Marmorstein, who was an Agudist, but taught at Jews College and is a famous scholar. Arthur Marmorstein wrote important work. So they're very interesting family. I heard from Rabbi Ben Elton, now the big rabbi in Sydney, Australia, that although Emil Marmorstein, who wrote a book called Heaven at Bay, that's Rabbi Avraham Marmorstein's father, was a theoretician of the Neturei Karta, his mother, although Rabbi Marmorstein told me he didn't know this, but this is what Ben Elton says, he's an expert on the English rabbinate, he wrote a whole book on it. He said his mother at the same time was one of the leaders of the Mizrahi, women's Mizrahi, so I don't know. He sends out emails occasionally. And I asked him, could I read this? And he said, fine. He sends out emails, all sorts of bibliographical things. It's, I don't know how many people are on his internal email list, if it's 10, if it's 30, whatever it is. I want to read you how it begins. And it's just Hashkacha Pratis, that right what we're going to discuss today, this is what he sends out. It goes on for five paragraphs here, all about bibliographical things. And the subject is No Rest for Weary Bibliophiles. And he says as follows, quote, I wanted to say Birkas Ilanos, but I got weighed down by the different nusach offered by Sefer Eshkol. And is it really Sefer Eshkol, or is it a forgery? And then he goes on. I wanted to read Rebecca Venden's quoted description of Karban Pesach from Shevet Yehuda on Erev Pesach, but got weighted down by the question of its authenticity. Then I started to debate why Rebecca Venden disputed the veracity of everyone else's sources, but was gullible in his own choices. And he goes on and on with all sorts of things that are out there, but are questionable. But the first one, he didn't know about the Nusach in the Birkas Ilanos in the Sefer Eshkol, and if the Sefer Eshkol is a forgery. So this is sort of like an inside baseball sort of thing. What do you mean Sefer Eshkol is a forgery? That's what we're going to talk about now. Most people don't know anything what I'm going to say right now, other than those in the academic world and some in the Torah world. It's a very distressing story. It's particularly distressing because descendants of the Auerbach family and of the Albeck family are both in Israel now, members of the Orthodox world, rabbis and scholars. And by the way, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was not from this Auerbach family we're going to discuss. Not only that, my friend told me that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach told one of the Albecks, a descendant of the Albeck we're going to speak about, that he agrees with his grandfather, Albeck, that it is a forgery. So what am I talking about now? And let me share my screen here. And the title of this is from Rasabi. I introduced it last week. We're talking about a work published by, hold on here, this individual, Rav Binyamin Hirsch, or Tzvi Binyamin Auerbach. He was a well-known rabbi, one of the leaders, he calls him here in Wikipedia, one of the most prominent leaders of modern Orthodox Judaism. That's modern Orthodox Judaism, M with a small M, not a capital M. He was a rabbi in a number of places, including in Halberstadt, and he published an important work in a number of volumes called The Eshkol by Avraham ben Yitzhak of Narbonne. I'll tell you about The Eshkol in a minute. His controversy is going to be with this individual, Sholem, Rabbi Sholem Albeck, who was more of an academic type, I guess, Jewish scholarship, but also, obviously, as you could see, part and parcel of the Orthodox world, although more of a Wissenschaft type of academic type of one. His son, incidentally, Chanoch Albeck. Chanoch Albeck is, you might have seen the Mishnayos, the Albeck Mishnayos. He was a scholar. So before I get into this great dispute that really split the academic world and to a certain degree the Torah world and continues to split them, let me tell you something interesting about the Eshkol. The Eshkol was published in the mid-19th century by Rabbi Auerbach together with his commentary called the Nachal Eshkol. It's quite long. I think it's four volumes because of the commentary, and it's a very nice commentary, and it gives you all sorts of explanations and things not just relating to that. In fact, I think the most famous and influential part of the Nachal Eshkol, he uses the Eshkol as a jumping off point to discuss all sorts of things, and he deals with this is my favorite because It had a great influence, I think, was, and he records something that we don't have recorded elsewhere. He tells us, what do you do on the fast days? Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, let's say it's in the summer. If you're up in Finland or Sweden, and it's the fast, what it ends, if you look on the, when it gets dark, if it ever gets really dark, but the fast ends like 12:30 a.m. and it starts like at 1:30. What do you, are you supposed to fast that long? These fasts are not supposed to be that long in normal places to live. Well, the Nachal Eshkol tells us that the practice in Stockholm in Sweden used to be that the fast of the 17th of Tammuz would always end 9.5 hours after Chatzos. They always ended it, even though it's bright light outside, they always would end it. Now, I looked online, and lo and behold, I found discussions of this, including an article in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, where the author writes, and he's not the only one to write it, that the practice in Stockholm was that they ended every night at 9:30. Every Shiva Sarvatam was 9:30 p.m. That's not correct. That's not what the Eshkol says. He says 9.5 hours after Chatzos. That doesn't have to be 9:30. I don't know when Chatzos is. Chatzos could be 12:30. But 9.5 hours after Chatzos. And this practice is defended in the Nachal Eshkol by Rabbi Auerbach. Incidentally, when I wrote about this a few years ago, I emailed the Chabad rabbi in Stockholm. I spoke to the rabbi from Norway. None of them do this anymore. And Stockholm in particular, they don't do it anymore. If you go to you can go to the Times on Chabad.org, and it'll tell you that the fast starts either start at midnight, and then it'll go all the way to, for example, in 2018, these are the figures. The fast started at 11:38. The fast ended at 11:38 p.m., but it began at 12:51 a.m. Rabbi Melchior also told me from Norway that they didn't follow this anymore either. Incidentally, there is a book called The Me'orei Or, from Aaron of Worms. He said that even on Tisha B'Av, in Northern Europe, they would end the fast when it was still light outside. Although the Nachal Eshkol only says Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Now, what's the logic? The logic of both what the Me'orei Or says and what the Nachal Eshkol says is that the idea is these are rabbinic fast days. And the rabbinic fasts were never you never took upon yourself this fast just to fast until end darkness all this time. You took on a normal time. And normal time, they figured, is 9.5 hours after Chatzos, no later. That was the logic. In other words, the problem is, as Rabbi Vosner points out, there's no source for this in the Rishonim. What Rabbi Auerbach is doing is defending a practice that developed, we're not sure how it is, with the very good logic, perhaps, when they made these fast days, they were talking about people in normal places where it actually got dark. Although I can tell you, I was in Berlin in the summer, and it ended, as I recall, after 9.5 hours. But still, the idea that you wouldn't have to wait forever. Now, when is this, other than being in Stockholm, you might say, well, why is this at all relevant? Well, it's relevant for a different reason. And Poskim have cited it. Because let's say you're in Israel on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, and then you fly to America, and the fast keeps getting longer and longer. Do you need to actually wait until you look outside and it's dark? Everyone assumes that if I'm flying from America, the fast ends when it gets dark out. So you might assume that you should do this or whenever it's supposed to end. You might assume that you have to be consistent going the other way. But are we consistent? Do we say that the fast can just be extended? You're flying west and it keeps getting extended. Most people say yes. You have to wait till it's dark. But there is an opinion that says no, that you should wait 9.5 hours, and that's when you do it. So that's the famous ruling. Rav Vosner, he says he doesn't like what the Nachal Eshkol says, but he says that you can at least wait till Shkia, because there's a dispute about these rabbinic fast days like Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Does it go to sunset or darkness? So he says you can wait at least till Shkia. So that's the most famous position, I think, found in the Nachal Eshkol, but it's of an important work. Question is it authentic? What do I mean, is it authentic? Well, it's published in the 19th century by Rabbi Auerbach. Some 35 years later, so 40 years later, Shalom Albeck, he comes to the conclusion, because he also is set to publish an edition based on a manuscript. Now, the manuscript that Rabbi Auerbach published, he gave it a name. No one's ever seen this manuscript. After he passed away, they couldn't locate it. And he said, this is the manuscript. Well, lo and behold, Auerbach has access to the one manuscript we have. It was in Frankfurt. It was in Halberstadt, actually, but it had earlier been in Frankfurt in Auerbach's lifetime. I think it would have been in Frankfurt still. It was with a family. Auerbach is examining it and says, something's wrong here. That Auerbach's manuscript, you can't have a manuscript like this. Why? Because it's citing all sorts of things that the medieval Eshkol wouldn't have known. And there's all sorts of things that just can't be there. So he publishes an open letter stating, now understand what he's saying. He's saying about this great rabbi, one of the leaders of Orthodoxy in Germany, that this is a forgery. That he couldn't, and not only is it a forgery, he's saying that Rabbi Auerbach must have forged it. Okay, this is a shock to accuse a great rabbi of this. And the response, understandably, from the rabbis of Germany was shock and outrage. They published a document called Tzidkat HaTzadik, justifying the tzaddik with people like Rabdovitzi Hoffman and others. And they acknowledge the problems in the manuscript. But they say that when you see a tzaddik, and we all know he was a tzaddik, you know, such a thing is just incomprehensible, and you must assume that there's an explanation, even if we don't know the explanation. Rabbi Zevin, when he discusses this dispute, says four against one. That is, you have these four great German rabbis against one, Albeck, and it seems like the victory goes to Albeck. That's what Rabbi Zevin says. The argument that we know is that tzaddik, well, that doesn't really carry much weight from a scholarly sense, because he's a tzaddik, but maybe there was some aspect of craziness. I don't know. Or maybe every time we hear about something that happens, some scandal, our response is always, how could that happen? He's the last person we ever would have expected this. So that's not necessarily the best argument, although we understand why to make such an accusation is it's very difficult to accept. But this became a huge dispute. And then people started calling attention to things like there's passages there from the Beit Yosef that appear in the Eshkol. There's references to expressions that could not have been said by a medieval. Originally, the defense of Rabbi Auerbach was, we don't know what happened to the manuscript. He must have had a manuscript. By the middle of the 20th century, the defense is different. Today, the defense is that there's an acknowledgement by everyone that it's for, including the family, that it must be a forgery. But Rabbi Auerbach was taken in unwittingly. That is, he had the manuscript, but someone else forged it. And he unknowingly, what you're saying about him is that he published a manuscript with all these passages in it that, prima gaudiums and things like that. But that's the defense that's offered today, that he was also misled. And we have cases where people are misled. The problem with this is you're saying he's not such a great Talmud Chacham as you thought he was, but that's better than saying he forged it. I don't want to take a stand on it. It's not for me to take a stand. You have to be a real expert in the medieval period. The reason I wrote to Rav Ratzabi is because Rav Ratzabi does take a definite stand that this is a forgery. I understand that if you're from the Auerbach family, this is a terrible thing to say. And I'm not saying it. I'm simply saying what they're saying. And maybe he did have a manuscript which was forged by someone else. I don't know. But this has cast a shadow on Rabbi Auerbach. And in the academic world, this has never cited this Sefer Eshkol as a source for medieval practices. Like it's like halfway the same as the other manuscript that Albeck published, but then you have all this other stuff thrown in. And in the Torah world, many people refuse to cite it because they say it's not authentic. And incidentally, it's not only now a German versus non-German thing. There's a well-known German Orthodox scholar who also agrees it's not an authentic work. I asked the Rabbi Ratzabi why, because here he's a Yemenite scholar. He's not really tied into all these Ashkenazic disputes. He says explicitly in his responsa that this is a forged work. So I said to him, why do you say it's a forged work? Remember, the early defense was that it's not a forgery. It can't be a forgery. He says, the reason I suspect forgery is because you see that there's new things in there that are taken from others. And he says, B'derech Kol, from the Beit Yosef, that is, the Beit Yosef quotes Rishonim, and that material, which is found nowhere else, is found in the Eshkol. So, you know, if you want to be a forger and you want to put in stuff from Rishonim, you would go to the Beit Yosef passages that we don't have anywhere else. And also he says the language, the signon, the style, which God has, he says, God has granted me the ability to see this. V'halavai shani toeh. He says, if only I am wrong, because his point is, I would like to be wrong, because then I wouldn't be accusing a big rabbi of this. Aval rachok be'enai. And he says, but it's rachok be'enai me'latzarfo al kol panim un halacha. But he doubts, and therefore I'm not going to take into account the Sefer Eshkol when I deal with halacha. I asked him if he knew this work, Kofar Eshkol. Albeck published a work, Kofar Eshkol. He didn't see it, but he did see Tikkat HaTzadik. And then he says, so then I asked him, this is a combination of two letters, then why do you quote the Nachal Eshkol? If you think that Rabbi Auerbach was responsible for a forgery, then why do you quote the Nachal Eshkol? And he says as follows, I bring the Nachal Eshkol al af hachashad shali neged Sefer Eshkol. I cite the Sefer Nachal Eshkol, the commentary, even though of my suspicion about the Sefer Eshkol. He says, because you shouldn't passel ideas that are worthy of being said mitzad atzmam on their own basis. In other words, if there's a good svara, a good logic in the Nachal Eshkol, why not cite it? But don't rely on the Sefer Eshkol as a halachic work. I don't know if Moshe Feinstein even knew about this dispute, because he cites the Eshkol all the time, and the Nachal Eshkol. And I think a good compromise is that has been proposed now, that yes, it's not an authentic work, but Rabbi Auerbach did not know this, and he published it. I can't explain why there's no manuscript. We never found it. You should be aware of this. If you do work in Rishonim, that the work, the Nachal Eshkol, everyone assumes now in the academic world and in the Torah world, I think, who investigate it, that it's not authentic. As to Rabbi Auerbach, you have people who do look upon him as a forger, and without really explaining why he would do that. Again, we're talking about a well-known rabbi, and others are very happy for understandable reasons to say that this is just something that he fell into him somehow and he didn't realize when he published it. And we have cases of this. We have examples of people who publish manuscripts not knowing their forgeries. We've had a number of cases of people who published manuscripts without realizing they were forgeries. And it's certainly a possibility that he published this not knowing. I'm not going to weigh in on that. But that's what this siman's about. The next siman, Kufnun Zion, the title is as follows. The forgery, the falsehood of Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin's opinion when it comes to the state of Israel in Moedim Halacha, the work, the festivals in Halacha in English. Who is Rabbi Zevin? Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, you can hear my classes on him from a few years ago on the Torah in Motion website. One of the great, great Torah scholars who knew everything. He was a Chabad Chassid, not a Lubavitcher. He was Babroisk. This is important because a Lubavitcher cannot be a Zionist by definition. Lubavitch is anti-Zionist. It's always been anti-Zionist. Today, people don't know this. Even the shulchim don't even know this. Half the shulchim you meet don't even know they're supposed to be anti-Zionist. And when I say anti-Zionist, it's not just Rashab, who was the leading anti-Zionist together with Chaim Soloveitchik in his time. The Rayatz and Rav Menachem Mendel was an anti-Zionist. But once the state is declared, you have to support it. But there's no religious significance, and they did not believe the state ever should have been declared. There's a big gap here between what official Chabad theology teaches and what the people know about it and what the shulchim know. And really, because in practice, there's no difference. Once the state is declared, and that's no different than Bells and Bubov, they were all anti-Zionist. But once the state is declared, now what are you going to do? How can you be anti-Zionist? You're going to be like these crazy Satmars who indoctrinate their kids to say that the state should disappear or what? So where are the Jews supposed to go? The Mediterranean? I mean, have some seichel here. By the way, the Satmar Rebbe, what he said was that the state will disappear in a way we don't understand it, in a way that the Jews will not be hurt. That's why they don't cooperate with Iran and things like that. So Rabbi Zevin was a Chabad, Babroisk. There was the third Lubavitch, the Tzemach Tzedek had children, and there was disputes over who would take over. And one branch became, of the children, it became a Rebbe, the branch became known as Kapus. and there was a lot of disputes between Kapust and Lubavitch. The last Kapust Rebbe, Kapust, by the way, is also the Rugachevers from that branch, Rav Kook's mother's from that branch. Kapust, the Rebbe, moves to Bobruisk. And when the last Rebbe, Rav Shemaria Noach Schneerson, dies in 1923 in the Soviet Union, he was one of the leaders of Torah Judaism, most of the Bobruiskers who were from Kapust, they joined together then with Lubavitch. But not all, and even the ones who join, like Rav Zevin, they don't give up their independence entirely, because they come from a different tradition in Chabad. Today, Chabad equals Lubavitch. But in previous years, there were different branches of Chabad, which were not Lubavitch. Incidentally, Rabbi Dalfin, he, in his books I've mentioned a few times, he discusses this. There's Avram Ehrlich discusses this and others. Rabbi Zevin was the rabbi of my step-grandfather's town, Nova Zipkov, in Russia. So there's a family, and he lived in their house for 6 months. So there's a bit of a connection here. Rabbi Zevin was a big Zionist, a Mizrahi supporter his entire life. He always signed the documents that the public calls to vote for the religious Zionist party. On Yom HaTzmaut, he would go to Mossad Harav Kook. Mossad Harav Kook has a shul, and he would daven there. And they said halal with a bracha there. He, we're told, only said halal without a bracha. But a huge religious Zionist. His grandson, Rabbi Nachum Zevin, who's just a regular Haredi rabbi, in the new edition that he put out of Modim B'Halacha, he speaks completely frankly about his grandfather's Zionism. And no one ever had any doubts on this. And in my next blog post, I'm going to pick up on something earlier I did about the famous anonymous letter saying that yeshiva students need to serve in the army. Did Rabbi Zevin write this? David Eisen did great work on this, and after all his research, we were left with, you can read about it, I'll give the link on the post, but this is already from a few years ago, we're left with, well, we're not sure. It seems Rabbi Zevin wrote it, but the family denies it, or at least most of the family, not all of it, and there's no smoking gun. Well, David, I have the smoking gun. I have all the thing that everyone said that, well, there's no proof. There's no question Rabbi Zevin wrote it, and therefore what everyone assumes is indeed correct. So Rabbi Zevin wrote a work, Hamoedim B'Halacha, The Festivals in Halacha. You can get it in English and Art Scroll. And I want to show you something he wrote in the, it's a great work of Hamoedim B'Halacha, if you haven't seen it. And if you don't know Hebrew that well, you can read the English. It was really the first of work of its kind. It published in the early 50s and became very popular. It is, I believe, in the post-war years, until Shmira Shabbos Kol Chasa, Rabbi Neuwirth, it was the most popular halachic work in Hebrew. I'm not talking about, let's say, Mishnah Berurah, things like that. It was the most popular original work, then Shmira Shabbos. It has been reprinted like 25 times. Until Shmira Shabbos Kol Chasa, I do not think there was any other work in the post-war years on halacha that was reprinted as often. And he wrote many other things, but the most famous is Hamoedim B'Halacha. He wrote La'or Halacha. That's the work that deals with Shemitah. It deals, has a chapter, Hasheleg B'Halacha, Snow in Halacha, and the famous chapter, Shylock in Halacha. He wrote many other works. Unfortunately, they haven't translated that into English. They did translate, Art Scroll translated his Sipurei Hasidim, Hasidic tales on the Parsha. But I want to show you what he wrote in his Hamoedim B'Halacha. It's this is in the section dealing with the fast days. We just were speaking about the fast days. And we have this notion that you're supposed to tear Kriya when you see the cities of Judah in their destroyed state. So if you would go and see, let's say, a destroyed Jewish city, you're supposed to do Kriya. Also the Makom HaMikdash, if you see that, where the Temple Mount. For some reason, that went out of style, and no one does Kriya on that anymore. Very few, I should say. My son and his yeshiva, they took him up there so they could all do Kriya. But even Rav Sternbach has a response. I'm asking, how is it that today people don't do it? People come from America. They go there. You could be at the Kotel. You don't see people rip shirts. And they come up with justifications. They say, I think Rav Sternbach's justification is, today we don't really have the feeling. So you're gonna feel worse that you're ripping your shirt than seeing the Mekom HaMikdash. They came up with all sorts of justifications. I'm not sure why the practice stopped. When I was in yeshiva, the practice still existed, and they took us, I think the first time, either Erev Shabbos or Shabbos. I think it was Shabbos. They took us so that the first time you saw it, you wouldn't have to tear Kriya, which I think I mentioned it before. I saw that as a bit strange, why we try to avoid it. But Rabbi Zevin discusses this whole issue, and then he says as follows. He discusses, what about the fact that now there's a state of Israel and the Jews control these cities? So Jews control, we're not talking about, this is before 67. So it would be the same issue if you went to Bethlehem, let's say, or Hebron. But before 67, that whole territory where there were Jewish civil towns and now are destroyed, what would you do it? So Rabbi Zevin says as follows. And because if you look in the post scheme, they describe if non-Jews rule over these cities. So he says, V'kasva post scheme, Churban an Sha'ari Yehudahu, what is the definition of the destruction of the cities of Judah? Sha'akum Moshe Malayim, non-Jews control them. So even if Jews are still living there, but non-Jews are in control of them, then he says, because the language the post scheme uses, non-Jews control these cities. Mistaber, shit. Im shichuran sha'arei Yehuda mishilton nachrim v'hakamat midan Israel. He's referring to before 67, but he's saying mistaber. It appears likely, it makes sense, that with the liberation of the cities in Judah from rule of the non-Jews and the establishment of the state of Israel, ashreinu shezachinu achach. Happy are us, fortunate are us that we've been worthy for this! Exclamation point. Then he says the commandment, the halacha to tear kriya, no longer, it's batel, it no longer is applicable. Nothing crazy Zionist here, nothing radical. He simply says now that the Jews control these cities, there should be no obligation to do kriya anymore, and have the establishment of the state of Israel, it's a great thing. That's what he's saying. It's a great thing that we establish the state of Israel. So would a Haredi say it? In the years after 1948, plenty of Haredim said this. And it's not an extreme Zionist statement. It's simply an expression of happiness that the state of Israel came into being. And if you go today and you ask the typical Haredi, no question, the readers of Art Scroll, is it a good thing that a state was established? They will say, of course, it's a good thing. They'll say it even more now than they would then, because now you see what it's meant for Torah and everything else. However, this very Parv statement was too much for Art Scroll, and this is how they translated the passage. And the letter we're going to hear is from Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, who's going to discuss this whole thing. But first, let me set the stage here, what Art Scroll did with this, and then we'll hear Rabbi Rappaport. This is the translation. It could be argued that since the liberation of the cities of the Judean hills from Gentile rule, the law of rending the garment for these cities may no longer be in force. So the first thing to notice is that Rabbi Zevin wrote Mistaber, which must be translated as it's reasonable or it makes sense or something similar. Art Scroll turned this into a tentative argument. It could be argued. That is, that's not what Rabbi Zevin's saying. He's not saying, the way Archibald has it, he's not taking a position. That's not what he's saying, though. Rabbi Zevin is taking a position. He's saying it makes sense that this should be. But the real egregious action of Archibald, and the one that created all the controversy, and the one that to this day has not been rectified, is those words, Ashreinu shezachinu achach. You know, happy are us, fortunate are we that we were zochet to have, after 2,000 years, a state. Art Scroll deleted mention of Rabbi Zevin's joy that the state of Israel was established. They just cut those words out. Now, after I wrote about this, I learned, even before I wrote about it, I should say, because I investigated it, that the men who run Art Scroll, Rabbi Sherman and Zadowitz, did not know about this censorship. They were shocked and surprised to see that this was done. They never authorized any distortion of the translation and were surprised to find out. However, once it was called to their attention, not only did they not take any steps to correct this mistake, on the contrary, they defended the alterations. And as I said, to this day, it hasn't been fixed. It's one thing if an art school's own works, it tolerates or even encourages distortions, but to take the writing of another person, a great Torah sage, and correct it in quotes to bring it into line with the current Haredi Das Torah is simply unforgivable. It's a violation of the sacred trust that every translator should be cognizant of. There probably also is an issue of Ganeva involved here. You sell a book, but you're not selling the complete book. You know, someone has an actionable claim. Now, this matter was raised at first. It first was called to everyone's attention years ago when in a letter to the editor in Tradition magazine by an individual who I don't know who he is, named Jack Feinholz. And then there was a response by Rabbi Nussan Sherman and Meir Zlotowitz. And this is their response. And it's in response to their response that we're going to see Rabbi Rappaport's letter, who also did important work on this. But let me read you what they said in their letter, in their response. This the work was translated by an individual named Meir Holder. Mr. Holder, and the work appeared right after Rav Zevin's death in English. Mr. Holder has, for many years, maintained the closest contact with Rav Zevin's family and has been a prime force in the dissemination of this great tzaddik's writings in both Hebrew and English, because this Meir Holder bought the rights to publish Rabbi Zevin's works in Hebrew and in any translations. It is unthinkable that he would tolerate or engage in any attempt to misrepresent Rav Zevin's thoughts. According to Mr. Holder, the lines with Mr. Feinholz's quotes were added to the edition published just a few months after the State of Israel was founded, a time when Rabbi Zevin and others still held high hopes for the spiritual impact of the state upon the lives of those Jews living there. As time went on, Rabbi Zevin became disappointed, and in the opinion of the members of his own family, his final halachic opinion with regard to the law of rending garments on seeing the Judean hills is more accurately reflected in the Art Score translation than the version of the passage cited by Mr. Feinholz. In other words, the translation of Art Scroll is more accurate than what you see with your own eyes in a work published like 20 times in Rav Zevin's lifetime. There's a good deal of falsehood here. Who are these mysterious family members that Mr. Holder consulted with? Rav Nachum Zevin, the one grandson of Rav Zevin, who's a Haredi rabbi, and as I told you, was completely honest in his descriptions, he tells anyone who asks that the change in the English translation was done without his approval, without anyone in the family's approval. And Rav Nachum Zevin is the one who deals with all this. And he says specifically, when we'll see this in Rabbi Rappaport's letter, when they signed the contract with Meir Holder, the contract was that he cannot change anything. And he did not change anything in the Hebrew. And he completely rejects this. And this... Let me read you now. Oh, I can't. It's already late. What Rabbi Rappaport did was that what we're going to see here is an investigation, not just of the whole Rav Zevin episode and his discussions with Rabbi Nachum Zevin, but also of the issue. Lo and behold, we'll see that Rav Moshe Feinstein says the exact same thing Rav Zevin says, that... B'chastei Hashem, Rav Moshe says that we have a state and now we're in a situation. There's not, and Rav Moshe, I mean, he wasn't a Tzioni like Rav Zevin. You don't have to be a Tzioni for this. Since it was just near Yom HaTzmaut, Rabbi Rakefa tells that the Bnei Akiva group in New York, went to Rav Moshe and asked him, could they say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut? And he said to him that for me, it's not such a Yom Tov. If you think it's a Yom Tov, you could say Hallel. But so we're going to see what Rabbi Rappaport says. It's a very, very important document. It's a scandal. I can't say it any less. It is a scandal what was done to Rav Zevin's writings and in this respect. And so we'll see the long letter next class of Rabbi Rappaport. I see it's already 9:30. We'll pick up with this. I've introduced it, though. Then we're going to see Rav Schechter, about Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, and Rabbi Gifter, and Rav Shechter about, and Rav Mazuz, the last one about Mazuz, about Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. Wait till you see what Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg says about the Brisker Derech and what we can say about that. So that'll be next week. Let me take the questions now and the comments. Also, we're going to see something great from Rabbi Soloveitchik about, we'll wait next week. I'll keep you waiting. There's always good stuff. You know there's always good stuff. Every week I'll give you good stuff, God willing. Let's get with the questions here, the comments. Thank you all again, always, for everything. The Sulzbach says, Yekis don't do Mayim Achronim. There's a discussion in the sources why that, why women today don't do that. I looked it up because someone asked me last week, and I said, well, today they don't, but in the past they must have. And I said probably because, I think I said, because it's no longer considered an obligation anymore. It's almost more either for mystical reasons or nostalgic reasons. And that's what the sources actually say. David Eisen says, in one of the early volumes of Masorah published by Rabbi Nachman Ganach, included a psak of a Soloveitchik that is opposed to the tune of Adon Olam that leads back to the first line of the song right after ending the piyut. Thus, one effectively says the heretical statement, V'lo ira Adon Olam. I don't fear Adon Olam. Okay. Interesting. Rabbi Kelman, Rav Hershel Shechter taught a number of people to take a mixed seating shul for Yamim Noraim. I think it's connected to his view that Orthodox rabbis should speak on panels with non-Orthodox rabbis. He felt that having an Orthodox influence is very positive, both as rabbi and speaker. And we know that Rav Shechter gave permission for people to take permanent appointments. He gave permission for one of the rabbis at the Beis Medrash HaGadol. This rabbi, I'm told, who took this position, then could not be a member of the CRC because they don't allow you if you have a mechitza shul, even though he had a heter from Rav Shechter, which is ironic because the CRC was precisely the organization which had all the mixed seating Orthodox rabbis because 90% of them, 90%, no, I think it was 90% of the mixed seating shuls were Skokie graduates. But there you're talking about just for Yamin Noraim. You can make the case, and that's why Rav Shechter, the Rav, said others are more lenient. You have these shuls that don't have rabbis. If you don't send an Orthodox rabbi there, then they're going to go with a conservative rabbi, and then I'll change the whole shul. And really, if you think about the Orthodox rabbi, he's sitting up on the front there. He's not sitting next to the woman. It's a violation. There's no question it's a violation, but the worst violation will come. You can make the case that if you don't go. So that's why the Rav, he didn't take a stand on it. But he didn't want balabatim. For a balabas to go into the shul, the mixed seating shul, that he didn't want. But I don't know. If you had a case like Rav Henkin, where you're stuck for, I'd say, 2 years, you're in a place in the shul, that's the only shul, I don't know what he would have said. But as a public statement, the Rav did think it was church. He thought it was Christianization. So it's not the machitza so much. The Rav never said that. There were certain shuls, liberal Orthodox shuls, that had separate seating, no machitza. The Rav never called that a church. Mixed seating, family pews, that the Rav said is an absolute imitation of the church and totally forbidden. I say totally forbidden unless someone would ask him and there's some extenuating circumstance, which I don't know about. Yaakov Yellen, they were called traditional. Yes, that was the term they used. They even had a whole movement. They called it traditional movement, which was centered in Chicago. Well, it was under the halachic guidance of Rabbi Regensburg. So you're going to say, what do you mean Rabbi Regensburg? What about the Rav? The Rav sent people out also. But the difference is the Rav, he sent them out to shuls. It was supposed to be for a few years. It was clear that it's not acceptable to Rabbi Regensburg. He never gave those restrictions. It would be better to have machitza, but if they're not going to put it in, you can take those shuls. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, when he came to Chicago, was very opposed to that, and I understand there was some tension there. Hyman says, the Rav permitted Rabbi Riskin to go to Lincoln Square for a limited period on the condition he would leave in a couple of years if he did not succeed in establishing Mechitza. I'm told that was the general thing. All of them were told, the Musmachim, you go, you take it for a few years. It often happened to end up staying many more years, and I could give you names of big rabbis. Does that mean they violated the agreement? Did they ask Dr. Belkin? Dr. Belkin was also involved. Dr. Belkin encouraged this very much. He was the one who was very much involved with Trude Weiss Rosmarin about risking getting that shul because she called up Belkin. So this is a famous, the Rav at one of the Chag HaSmichas, I heard this from Uli Bernstein, the Rav said that not just rabbis should take it, the best rabbis should take these shuls. But here we're talking about rabbis who are going there to do fighting the battle. And we're not talking about individuals who, that's different. It's Kirov. For the rabbis, it's Kirov. In fact, Rabbi Riskin never davened, he says, in the shul, which the Rav never said. That the Rav said, of course you can daven with them. But Rabbi Riskin, you can ask him why, but apparently I asked someone who knew him and he said he wanted to be more strict because Rabbi Riskin was a firmer then, not today. No one would call him being a firmer today. But the Rav never said to take these shuls and don't daven, but Rabbi Riskin supposedly never actually davened in the shul without the mechitza. Rabbi Cowan says you can listen to a fascinating interview with Rabbi Riskin where he explains how the Rav deferred to Dr. Belkin. Oh, that Rabbi Riskin should take the position of Lincoln Square, even as it was a conservative shul. So you're saying not an Orthodox shul with no machitza, but an actual conservative shul.
Yeah, you have to listen to the interview. Basically, what happened is Dr. Belkin, Lincoln Square started, he does the whole story. It was conservative how the shul got started. They were in a hotel, whatever. And then Dr. Belkin called him in to tell him to take the job. And Rabbi Riskin immediately told Rabbi Belkin, it's usher. The Rav says, it's usher. I can't take the job. He says, a little bit, you know, chutzpah dick to tell Dr. Belkin. And the next day, the Rav calls in Rabbi Riskin. And the Rav says to Rabbi Riskin, I want you to take the job. He said, what do you mean? He said, I spoke to Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin lives on the west side. He understands the situation much better. And you have, if Dr. Belkin says you should take the job, take the job. And that's what he said. He took the job on condition he not daven there, like you point out, and he not get paid. He said they liked that condition, that he not get paid. And he was getting sort of a scholarship from YU. And remember, the family, I don't think, had any money, and he got a scholarship. He was supposed to go to Harvard. I believe Rabbi Riskin was supposed to go to Harvard. And at the last minute, he spent Shavuos in YU, and he decided to go to YU, and his aunt got him in, and there was no money, and Dr. Belkin accepted him, you know, with no money, and he felt he owed it to YU, basically, to go, and as I say, the rest is history. It's really a fascinating interview. At the time, he said it's the first time in his life that anybody had ever interviewed Elliot, you know, interviewed him. And it was the first time that anybody had interviewed him really on his life story. So if you want to listen, I put the link up.
I will listen. He also, he published his autobiography where he discusses as well. But you can go through the list. There are many YU Musmachim in Lieberman and the Orthodox. I give percentages who took shuls like this, some temporarily, but others not. And with the time, you can make the case that it was a smart step. Because 20 years, those shuls, as long as they still had OU, as long as they still were OU shuls and RCA rabbis, with the turn to the right, with the growth of the day school movement, with the young people going to day schools, they were able to turn these into mechitza shuls, where the ones where the Orthodox rabbis didn't have, which were identical, basically, the old-time conservative shuls, they ended up going egalitarian. So maybe Rabbi Regensburg in the end was correct. It's an interesting case. Rabbi Meir Kahana, Howard Beach, his shul was a non-machitza shul, and he came from the Mir. One day, he got a few of his guys to come in. They put a machitza in. The balabatim come in the next day, and they're like, "What's this doing here?" And that was the machitza. Meir Kahana put it in, and it stayed. And they were very upset.
It's also part of the historical current. I remember we had a J.J. Schachter was giving sort of a whole, you know, to a number of us rabbis a number of years ago. And you have to understand the Rav's position in the context of the 1950s, where Orthodox shul after Orthodox shul turned conservative. You know, here in Toronto, all the shuls when they were downtown were Orthodox. And when they moved uptown in the 50s and 60s, all turned conservative. And there was I don't want to use the word war, that's not in, but there was a spiritual battle. And in that context, it said, I don't know that the Rav would say today. And of course, Rav Lichtenstein has his famous piece where he disagrees. Basically, he says, you're not going to tell me that. I don't think the Rav would disagree with this either. The Rav was talking to a firm person. But I think the Rav would agree a reform person is better for him to go to reform shul than not to go to shul at all. And that's what Rav Lichtenstein says very clearly, 100% clearly in print and et cetera. Okay.
That's why these ads every year, they come out.
They're ridiculous.
Buddhist Rabbanim saying, take an ad, let's say, in the Jewish Week of the New York Times saying, don't go in the show. But these are people who are not going to go in the show anyway.
Right.
Naftali said, Feldheim published 2-volume set on the Auerbach Rabban. And they did. Very, very good work. Important work. Mark says, how long is 10th Tevet in Stockholm? I don't know. It's a good question. You can go on the Chabad website, though. Good, not that short, I don't think. You can go on. I'll look afterwards. Chabad has all the zmanim, and I'll see. I'll report next week. Incidentally, the times are not the exact same between Chabad and the other shuls. The Auerbach family has published good stuff. I had just translated from German, so it was tough work, and I'm going to have someone look it over. Moses Auerbach, who's also from that family, he wrote a very interesting document in the 31 or 32, explaining the German Orthodox approach to secular studies and why it's vital to be part of the Western world. I hope to publish that. The person who emails me privately, I can find it. Yaakov says, Rabbi Yaakov Yellen, regarding the theory that a tzaddi can't produce a forgery, well, then review Adol Rosenberg. Yeah, a Talmud Chacham produced a number of forgeries. Although, in the end, Schneier discovered something in the community library in Montreal. They did they honored him at the end of his life, and he produced a bibliography. And all these things, these stories, the Golem, he includes them under Folks Literature. So even he, for his legacy, although he left hints. I mentioned this once. He would leave hints in his works that it's not to be taken real most of the time, although he did publish a few tshuvos of Gaonim, which also are forgeries. I don't know what to make of Yudel Rosenberg. Rabbi Kelman actually served in his pulpit, his successor.
He was the founder of, I believe, Eitz Chaim here in Toronto.
Yes, he was.
And he was the rabbi at Bet Jacob when it was downtown, and I was there for 9 years as the rabbi, many, many years later. And of course, he's Mordechai Richler's father,
grandfather, I think.
Grandfather. He's Mordechai Richler's grandfather.
He mentions it in the article.
Yeah, correct.
But it does prove that you can have a gadol. He was a gadol writing forgeries.
Maybe he's not a gadol. If he's writing forgeries, he's Talmud Chacham. He's definitely a Talmud Chacham, and he wrote one of the first works on electricity. He corresponded for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on it. Ira Robinson has written a good deal about it. Shmuel says there's a well-known story there of Zevin after publishing a Sipurei Hasidim was meeting with a Litvish Rav who lightly reprimanded him that putting out a work on Hasidic stories was beneath his dignity. Rav Zevin, in his way, replied, "Still, Sipurei Hasidim was a bestseller." I have an unpublished tshuva of Rav Zevin, which I discovered, which I'm going to publish. The issue of tradition, it's all in my article. My post. If you just Google it, on this issue. I don't have it on hand. David says, as we discussed in the past, the Rav Poskin is better to miss listening to the shofar if one could only fulfill the mitzvah by hearing it in a conservative synagogue. Yes. And why was that his psak? I heard personally with my own ears from Rabbi Parnas, hardly one of the liberal students of the Rav. I heard it because Rabbi Parnas' son was my Rebbe in 11th and 12th grade. And we went to his Rabbi Parnas' son Junior's house and Rabbi Parnas Sr. came to speak to us, and I asked him this question about the Rav. He said it was Hara'asha, which is exactly what Rabbi Kelman said. It was an emergency time, he said, because if it wasn't an emergency time, if the only way you can hear the shofar is maybe doing that, maybe you could find a way to permit it. But he said that we are fighting a battle against the non-Orthodox, and it was important to show people that this is actual halacha, machitza, not just like a different style, not just different, some people like it, others do it differently. This was an issue even with the Orthodox. Rabbi de Sola Poole from the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue writes that this is a battle we're probably going to lose and we're going to have to accept that some shuls are going to be mixed seating. And the Rav refused to accept that. Mel says, I believe Rokevitz said that when Merkana put in machitza and Harabichi got fired, he got fired. Okay, maybe he did. I don't recall. And Hyman says, a few years ago, I bought a reprint of Besamim Rosh, widely recognized as a forgery. I spoke to Dr. Lyman about it. He confirmed it's a forgery, but it doesn't mean it's bad Torah. It's pretty good. Yes, we'll end with this. When we do the classes on the rise of reform, I will argue that the author of the Besamim Rosh, Rav Shaul Berlin, he is the first of the reformers. And this is a forgery, and I will show you that certain poskim have said what they do is they cite the passage in the Gemara and Sanhedrin about Ben Sira. They say that which is good about it, you can take. In other words, if there's positive things, so if there's a good svara, we rely on the svara in the Besamim Rosh or in the Kasa D'Harsana, which is Shaul Berman's commentary, we don't rely on it for itself. That's no different than anyone. If someone gives a good argument or points out a source, you can rely on it. And finally, the Sulzbach say, maybe what we now dismiss as forgeries were in ancient times passed as pseudepigrapha. Well, that's true. Is it a forgery when you buy a book called the Sefer Yetzirah? On the front page, it says that the title page says written by Avraham Avinu. Is that a forgery? The person who write it, or all these other works, the Testament of Naphtali, is that a forgery? I don't think it's a forgery. It's pseudepigrapha. So what did the author think when they're writing that? I heard from someone who works in Art Scroll. He knows a lot. He's one of the people who works on the Hebrew Talmud. He said what he thinks is that the person who, when they would write texts like this, they thought that the spirit of the author worked through their pen. So for instance, the person writing this, he thought, assuming he's the one who did it, that could have been a later title page, but if someone were to write something and say that and then put on the title page, Avraham Avinu wrote it, it's like he felt that Avraham was speaking through him, or maybe that's what it means. But is that a forgery? No one actually expected that, I think, them to believe that Avraham Avinu wrote it. That's a different issue. Pseudepigrapha, correct. Thank you all. This was very nice to be with you again tonight, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. I look forward to next week. Just tomorrow, two shiurim back to back, or Wiskin, both part two on Chassidut, the Baal Shem Tov's revolution. Followed at 1:30 by Ilana Goldstein Sachs on Megillat Rut. Second series, so we invite you. And then Wednesday, two new shiurim starting Marty Lakshin at 11 o'clock on Midrash Halacha and Pshat, the interaction between the three of them, and Lori Novak on a four-part series on Woman and Kriyat HaTorah, a look at the sources. So we look forward to learning. And then Thursday, Yeshuli Mishkan, Parsha Night, my shiur Friday morning, Perkei Avot. So we look forward to learning with you and to bring your friends and comments, questions, and thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful week and a good night, and all the best. Thank you.